I was with a small gathering of pastors of underground churches, and another pastor who was there with me told that story and just kept talking about how Jesus calls us to do the one thing that we cannot do, and in our inadequacy and shame and failure, God is present with strength. And amazingly, people in that room just started to stand up and confess and weep and cry out to God.
This is the Made to Advance podcast. I'm your host, Brian Olick. We're here to inspire and equip you for your best future.
Well, welcome everybody. It is so very good to be with you today. And I want to ask, before we even get started with our conversation, if you have appreciated Made to Advance, please rate and review us. That helps us get the word out about the podcast to more and more people. And it also helps us bring on more incredible guests like the one we have today. Today I have with me Dr. John Ortberg, and John has served as a lead pastor and teaching pastor at incredible churches all around the U.S. He's also written too many great books for me to summarize here. So do yourself a favor, look up his books on Amazon. I am sure you will find something that you will love. Currently, John is leading a very cool ministry called Become New, which we're going to spend some time talking about today. But on a personal level, John was a mentor to me at the very beginning of my marriage and ministry life more than 20 years ago. And what he shared with me has absolutely changed my life, and God has used his influence to greatly shape both my life and my leadership today. And so, John, I want to just say welcome to the podcast. It is so great to have you with us.
Well, those are far too generous and gracious of words, but I will accept them anyway, and thank you, and love to get to talk about what we'll be talking about.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to it. Now, I need to do the mandatory temperature and weather comparison just to kind of feel the salt in my wound of Michigan right now. So here we have a beautiful mid-30s degree day with a unpleasant mixture of rain and snow at the same time. I think you're in Santa Barbara, California. What are you enduring at the moment?
Yeah, it's blue skies and sunny and high 60s, and yesterday it was blue skies and sunny and 70, and tomorrow it'll be blue skies and sunny and 70. So it's just part of the beautiful contrast of the earth.
I feel like people who write about spiritual formation should have a separate spiritual practice that just is called living in a great climate. There's a connection there somewhere.
And, well, partly for me, it's I married a great person, and my wife Nancy is a California girl. And as you know, we lived back in Chicago for almost a decade, and she complained every single day, and just thought that Chicago was a really, really difficult place to live. Too cold, too much snow, no mountains. She said it was like God took an iron and flattened everything out. So I am here in California partly simply because if I want to remain married, then I do. it's part of the deal.
Well, it's funny, as I'm looking at the place you're sitting now, I know that on a recent video you said you and Nancy were moving to a new house.
Yes.
And this setup looks really good. I honestly wondered if it would look like you were in a state of disarray with having just completed a move somewhat recently. I don't know exactly how recently, but boy, you've got things dialed in back there. I feel like I'm ready to move in with you.
Now, we lived in the Bay Area for 21 years, but we were just renting a place up there. And so we realized years ago, we need to get equity someplace. So we actually bought a little house in Santa Barbara 12 or 13 years ago and have owned it. But we just moved here full time 2 months ago.
Okay.
And yes, this is my office, and it is my favorite room ever. I love this room.
I bet. I can see why. Well, it really is an honor to have you on the podcast today. And it's funny because if I had to pick one John Ortberg book that has been impactful in my life, it would hands down be If You Want to Walk on Water, You've Got to Get Out of the Boat. I can absolutely say that had God not use that book in my life, in Getty Church, and all of its influence would not exist today. And it's affected many more things than just that. But there are so many different books and teachings that you've shared that have been influential. And it's funny because a few years ago, I kept hearing this name, John Mark Comer, all the time. Oh, you got to check out John Mark Comer, John Mark Comer, John Mark Comer. So finally I say, okay, I'm going to read something that John Mark has written here. And I think it was his, maybe his first book, I'm not sure. But I start reading John Mark, and I'm going through the pages, and everybody's, oh, this is so good. And I thought, I think this sounds very similar to things that I learned from John Ortberg about 20-some years ago. And since then, I've learned that, of course, you have a friendship with John Mark and have been a mentor to him. But it really gave me fresh gratitude for hear all these people just being impacted by John Mark Comer. And I thought, how cool is it that so much of what he's putting out there in a fresh way is our ideas and principles that I had the benefit of learning right at the beginning. And so I thought what we would do is, since I am talking to John Mark, one of John Mark Comer's mentors, since I am talking to the OG, the original Jedi here, I thought we would just start by talking about one of your books, which is The Life You've Always Wanted. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I don't know if you would agree with this, I think that Life You've Always Wanted has a fair bit of overlap with some of the things that that John Mark has started writing on and picked up on over the years. So maybe we could start there. You could tell me a little bit about that book. I'm hoping many will go, I've got to pick up John's book, like Life You've Always Wanted.
Well, every one of us, you know, if we learn, we get to learn because of other people. And for me in particular, it's very hard for me to think about or talk about any items that are related to personhood, faith, life change, God, without thinking about Dallas Willard and things that I learned from Dallas. So, you know, in a conversation like this, I could pretty much say probably if there's anything that's going to be helpful to anybody, it will have found its source back in Dallas. And I could just cite him with almost every sentence, and that would probably be, you know, the most accurate way to go. And Dallas passed away now quite a few years ago, a little more than a decade ago. But he would be the first person to say, actually, none of this was original with him. It goes back to Jesus above all, ancient wisdom about the nature of personhood and life. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, it just tends to get lost and then recaptured and lost and recaptured. And in my own case, I was always really interested in theology, also in psychology. How do people change? Why do they change? Why is change so hard? Those questions were the ones to me that were always the most important to think about. And what happened was I had hit a point where I was a pastor. I had gotten a wonderful education that I'm really grateful for. But I felt frustrated because I felt like I'm not growing in ways that I want to. And I don't feel like I'm getting to know God better. And I don't feel like I'm changing in ways that I would like to change. And I don't know what to do. And I know I'm supposed to pray and read my Bible. Those were like the only two arrows in my quiver at that time. But I don't have a theory of change, to put it that way, to use that language, mm-hmm. that's connected to how I'm living or how to actually pursue change. And then I picked up this book called The Spirit of the Disciplines by this man named Dallas Willard. And in the preface, he says his thesis is that authentic transformation is really possible if we're willing to do one thing, and that is to arrange our lives around the practices and rhythms that Jesus engaged in to remain constantly at home with and receiving power from his Father. And when I read that sentence, I think partly, Brian, because I was so frustrated. There's an old saying, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And I probably could have read that 10 years earlier and it wouldn't have impacted me at all. But because I felt so much frustration and I was hungry, that sentence gave me hope that there were bright people who had thought about this deeply. So I began to read Dallas, and then that gave me kind of a lens through which to read other folks as well. Mm-hmm. And I learned that things like spiritual practices are just the means to an end. They're not an end in themselves. And the means to which they are an end is just life. And so that really did impact, in significant ways, I would say, changed my life, or at least the way that I tried to arrange it. Mm-hmm. So, yes, that book, The Life You've Always Wanted, I would, and still sometimes think about as kind of Dallas for Dummies.
Right.
How do you take wisdom about these issues and make it available and accessible to ordinary folks? So that's what that book was an attempt to do. And that was a very, very meaningful venture for me.
If you, John, had to point folks to a book to begin a journey, if they were to try to read Dallas, and Dallas is a little bit more of a demanding read, mm-hmm. where would you suggest they start?
Yeah. I'll just say, for me, that book, The Spirit of the Disciplines, mm-hmm. is the one that turned lights on. So folks could start there. For better or for worse, with Dallas, his mind and language are such that it just often takes most of us a while to get it or to catch on. And it always felt to me like reading Dallas is kind of like osmosis. And you just go back through it and go back through it and go back through it. So actually, literally, Brian, to this day, I am constantly rereading or re-listening to Dallas. Hmm. And part of what's going on there is he taught philosophy for many years at University of Southern California. And when he was dying of pancreatic cancer, Nance and I went and helped to clean out his cortiary library. His whole house was just a library. Then he had a secondary library at USC in his office. And then he, as Jane, and had bought another house, and they turned that whole house into a library. And then they had gotten another garage. So this is library number four. And we packed up, I don't know how many thousands and thousands and thousands of books in boxes. And I realized going through that, Dallas had literally read everything of significance from Homer on about the human condition. And then worked very, very hard to try to understand in a real clear and actually simple way, what did this person mean by this word or this idea? And then he would sift through all of that to work very hard on what did he understand. So I would sometimes play a kind of a game to him where I would just ask him, what do you mean by beauty? Beauty is goodness made manifest to the senses. Joy is a pervasive sense of well-being. Spirit is disembodied personal power. There was just no word that you could think about where there wouldn't be this immense clarity to Dallas. And that's why when we read him, there'll be these sentences, and he doesn't use technical vocabulary. He doesn't use real complicated theological or philosophical words, but there's a density to what he writes mm-hmm. that just takes time to grasp. And that's because every word is like the tip of an iceberg. If nothing else happened as a result of our conversation, but a number of folks saying, I think I'll start reading some stuff by this man or listening to talks that are available through, you can just Google Dallas Willard Ministries. I will personally offer you a money-back guarantee. It will serve you really well. I actually wouldn't worry too much about where you start. Just go real slow.
Yeah.
Look for a thought or a sentence that you can dwell on for a little while, and over time, clarity will emerge.
I've read Divine Conspiracy. I'm blanking out on the title all of a sudden.
That was a book of his, The Divine Conspiracy.
Yeah, Divine Conspiracy. Okay, thank you. Yeah, for a second there, I thought I've got that wrong. But I have read passages from Divine Conspiracy and chapters so many times over, and I would be, I'm sure, myself shocked at how many times I've probably said things and not even realized I was quoting Dallas, just because it's some of his work and thinking has become so embedded.
Can I say one more word about that?
Yeah.
I was talking to Dallas one time, And this, I think, is related to a lot of us, probably especially pastors, but really everybody, because we live in an age of information overload. And I'll always feel guilty about, oh, there's all these books and articles and websites and podcasts that I haven't read or listened to, and I feel so far behind. And then what he said to me when I asked him, so I asked him, like, how do you do that? How do you read? How do you take in content? And he said, when it comes to reading, especially when you're thinking about how do you form your mind, you know, where do you want your mind to dwell? What do you want to have the key mental furniture in your life? He said, aim at depth, not breadth. Hmm. Because if you aim at depth, you will get breadth thrown in. But if you aim at breadth, you will end up with neither breadth nor depth. Wow. So the idea is, when we think about something like spiritual formation or spiritual growth, the human condition is a constant. And so our tendency to hide, to live in denial, to rationalize is a constant. So we'll always need to learn, how do I do self-examination? And then how do I do confession with another person?
Mm-hmm.
And if you really master that, if you go deeply into, pick a person, Luther, Ignatian, Wesley, Dallas Willard, if you go deeply into any one person, they will walk you through how and why you do something like that. So once that's deeply a part of you, then when you read somebody else from a different tradition, you'll come to that same idea and you will say, oh, I recognize this. I know this. So if it's deeply in you, then when you go to other places, that's where you get breath thrown in. You'll see those ideas discussed in different languages, but you'll recognize it. If I'm always just buzzing around like a bee from this to this to this and reading superficially, that stuff will never become part of my mental map, my mental furniture, and I'll never get it. So that was really helpful to me and hopefully to folks listening to us. When you're trying to figure out how do you really want your mind formed, how do you get those ideas that you want to go very deep and just become a part of you, look for somebody who really helps you. Look for a writer that you can really benefit from, and then go really deep with them. Read them slowly, read them over and over and over, and you will find the way that you think being changed and the way that you live being changed. And just let go of feeling guilty about not reading or absorbing everything out there.
Well, that is such a good word. I hope everybody listening right now is taking that to heart. And that last part is such a big deal. I remember, even as a pastor of a growing church, I remember some younger pastors coming to me for advice, wisdom, coaching, and they would ask, well, have you read such and such? Have you listened to so-and-so? And I thought, man, this is weird. I feel like I'm part of a very flourishing ministry, but talking with this person, I'm feeling kind of foolish right now.
Yeah.
And you really have to be comfortable. You know, maybe it says more about me that I'm feeling foolish for not knowing all these different people, but you really have to be comfortable with, I'm going to choose to be ignorant about all these different folks and influencers and all this so I can go deep with a few and believe that's going to pay off. Now, I'd love for you, John, thinking about people, and there are people all over the spiritual map that are listening to this conversation. If we could talk about spiritual disciplines for a minute, if you were just to tell us, maybe people have heard the term spiritual discipline or spiritual practice before, but maybe you could give us a definition of, here is what a spiritual discipline is, and then perhaps some examples, and you've already referenced actually a couple examples, but just so people can put them together, here's what a spiritual discipline is by definition, and then here are some examples of a spiritual discipline or practice.
Yeah, that's a wonderful topic. I wish my wife was with us right now, because if she was, she would be throwing up in her mouth a little bit, because Nancy hates the phrase spiritual disciplines, and a lot of people do. Discipline, that's not a very inviting word. It sounds rigid. It sounds militaristic. It sounds like punishment. So other language might be helpful to folk: practices or rhythms, activities, habits. At the core is a real simple notion. And again, I got this from Dallas, but it's way older than that. And the central idea is there's an enormous difference between what I can do by trying versus what I can do by training. And so, for example, when Paul's writing to the church at Corinth, he says, train yourself to godliness. As you know, when runners run, they all enter into strict training. They do it. They enter into training to win a prize that won't last. But we do it. We enter into training to win a prize that will last forever. So what is that about, training or trying? Well, if you just start with running, like Paul does, the idea is, if I want to run a marathon, people who are listening to us right now, probably most of us can run a marathon if we really wanted to. We might not be able to do it by just going out today and trying really, 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 really hard. So what do I do if I want to run a marathon? Well, I train. What does it mean to train? To train mean I arrange my life around those activities through which I receive the power to do what I cannot now do by direct effort. Training is arranging my life around those activities through which I receive power to do what I can't do right now.
So good.
I can do many, many things by training that I cannot do by trying. It's a fundamental distinction that significant transformation always has to recognize. If I want to develop musical abilities, how do I do that? Well, I can't just sit down at a piano and try really, really, really hard to play Beethoven or something, but I take lessons and I practice scales and I learn how to read music. And that's true when it comes to sports. It's true when it comes to language. And it's no less true when it comes to spiritual life. So often in churches, people just get crushed in their spirits because they hear, well, Jesus was patient, so you got to be patient like Jesus. And they think, well, I'll try really, really hard to be patient, or I'll try really, really hard to be joyful. And generally, that doesn't work any better than trying really, really hard to run a marathon or play a complicated piece of music. We enter into training, we arrange our lives around practices through which we receive the power to do what I can't do now by direct effort. And so that's all a spiritual discipline is. A discipline is a practice I engage in order to receive the power to do what I can't do now by direct effort.
That's such a great explanation. And I know sometimes, and I had this question early on in my journey, people say, well, okay, so if it's this practice I'm doing, then how is God involved with the transformation? Yes. If it's just this thing I'm doing? And you gave an illustration so many years ago, and I wonder if you still use it today. You use the illustration of sailing and saying essentially that the spiritual practices or disciplines are like when we put our sail up, and it's still up to God to provide the wind of the Holy Spirit to really empower those spiritual disciplines or practices for transformation. Would you still put it that way? Did I get it right, John? Or are you like, boy?
Actually, I think you said it way clearer than I ever have. But yeah, it's, you know, there's that passage in John where Jesus talks about the Spirit is like the wind. And you know, in biblical languages, Hebrew and Greek, the word for spirit is also the word for breath and is also the word for wind. Mm-hmm. So if you think about a boat, you could have a motorboat. That's where I'm doing everything. I'm in charge. I've got the engine. I provide the power. On the other hand, you could have a raft. And in a raft, I'm completely passive. I'm doing nothing. I'm just drifting based on where the currents of the tides go. But with a sailboat, it seems like it's kind of an apt analogy for spiritual life, where if the wind is not blowing, if the Spirit is not at work, I'm not going anywhere. But I'm not passive. There is something for me to do. And I have to discern the wind and respond to it and put up the sails and adjust them and tack. And so, yeah, I think to think of the spiritual life in that way, and you know, part of what that helps us recognize is even the notion of training, as important and helpful as that is, can still leave me and my little ego in control.
Mm-hmm.
So a weightlifter or a musician, you know, could say, well, I'll engage in training, but it's all about my agenda and I'm in charge. And now, an interesting alternative to this one is somebody who's an addict, an alcoholic. And if I'm in the grip of an addiction, the place where I have to start is with my own powerlessness. You know, the 12 steps for folks who know that. Recognize that we were powerless over alcohol, whatever sin, and our lives had become unmanageable. And then came to realize a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And then made the decision to turn our lives and our will over to the care of God. So at the foundation is surrender. And now I can be a weightlifter and not surrender. I can be a musician and not surrender. I cannot be a follower of Jesus without surrendering.
That's right. Yeah. And
I can't actually be freed, interestingly enough, from an addiction, which is an attachment to my desire, my ego, my will. And so I think understanding the foundational base for spiritual life really is a posture of surrender. Not my will, but yours be done. I will become a follower of Jesus. And so that's where that sailing analogy also brings in the fact that this is not my motorboat. It's not my boat. It's the Spirit that provides the power, that provides the grace. So if I'm sailing, I'm living by grace. I'm not just forgiven by grace. I am traveling from one moment to the next moment to the next moment because of the gift, the power, the winds of the Spirit. But then that's a very active life, discerning and responding constantly to what grace is doing. And that would include, what are the kind of practices that might be helpful to me? And that might vary over time. It'll be different for me than it is for you. So it's not like this rigid, militaristic, you know, predictable, formulaic approach to the spiritual life. It's much, much more individualized and sensitive and fluid than that.
I think that's such a good word, because I think sometimes when people begin to learn about the spiritual disciplines, and maybe they've read Richard Foster's classic book, or maybe they've read Dallas's, or maybe they've read yours, and it can feel like, and I've seen this happen many times, people read about all of these great spiritual practices. And in your book, you do a great job saying, hey, it doesn't, a great spiritual practice doesn't even have to be one of the classics out of the Bible. You can devise some of those on your own, and I'll leave somebody to read the book to find out all about that. But sometimes people can think, oh my goodness, I need to be doing this and this and this and this and this. And really what you're saying is, you need to engage the kinds of disciplines and the rhythm of life that best suits the transformation you need. I mean, and probably has something to do with your wiring as well. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. One of the most important principles to remember is that spiritual practices or disciplines are a means to an end. They are not an end in themselves. They are not ways that we earn brownie points with God. We don't demonstrate how spiritual we are by spiritual disciplines. And in fact, there's always a danger with those kind of practices. And nobody taught about this more clearly than Jesus. So we'll think about prayer as a really good spiritual practice. And it can be. But one of his more famous stories is about the Pharisee and the tax collector. And the Pharisee goes to the temple and prays, I thank you, God, that I am not like other people, like that tax collector over there. I fast twice a week and give a tithe. His prayer was making him worse. He would have been a better person if he didn't pray, because it was making him more self-righteous and self-focused and judgmental and feeling superior. And it was killing love. And the spiritual disciplines are always a means to an end. And the end that they're the means to is just life. And at the top of that list of life is becoming a loving person and then joyful. And then, so asking, is this practice helping me to become a more loving person? And if that Pharisee would have been a discerning person, or had discerning people in his life, they might have been able to help him see, actually, it's killing love in you, and you would have been much better off. So I think it's a wonderful thing that there has been a kind of a rediscovery of practice and disciplines in our life. We'll never be able to grow well without them, but they always come with a danger. Lauren Winter has written a book, I think it's called The Dangers of Spiritual Practice, where she walks through with the practices and then just thinks about them. There's always that danger that I'll turn into the elder brother mm-hmm. in the story of the prodigal son, and it will choke off humility and love and joy. So for people to recognize that these disciplines are a means to an end, I am not spiritually mature because I engage in a lot of practices. I actually do them because I need them in order to have the power to change.
Would you say, John, that there are any practices that, though we might tailor what practices we're engaging in based on where we most need growth and perhaps our own personal wiring, are there any practices that are so foundational you can hardly imagine not practicing them as someone who desires to become more like Christ?
Yeah, I think for sure there are practices that we will need to engage in. Now, we might need to take a break periodically if it's leading us in the wrong way. So prayer, communicating with God, talking with God and seeking guidance from God, mm-hmm. that's indispensable. But I was in a prayer group many, many years ago. One of the guys in it was a judge. I don't remember him. And we had to make a commitment to pray 30 minutes a day as part of this group. And he came in one day and said, I've now prayed 32 days in a row. And the woman that was leading our group said, okay, your assignment tomorrow is don't pray. And I grew up in a church where we would never have said that. We'd have said, man, you could be the Cal Ripken of prayer. Keep going. You could set a new record.
Yeah.
But what she was recognizing was, in your case, it's actually breeding this self-conscious, self-obsessed, judgmental root in you. So you got to take a break from prayer. But that doesn't mean you never pray again.
Yeah.
To be in conscious contact with God, that will be key. Our minds are fundamental to who we are. And so feeding our minds thoughts that we want our minds to dwell on, because sin, brokenness, unhealth will always pull us towards rumination. So exposing our minds to great thoughts, and particularly the scripture, and especially the life of teaching, of the teaching and ministry of Jesus, that will always be central. We are influenced by other people so much, and it just gets inside us that when I'm talking with you, I can start to think, I wonder what Brian will think about this, and how can I say something that Brian will agree with or that he thinks is impressive? So solitude, because the impact of other people, and especially in our day with all the electronic tethers that we have and stimulation, to pull away from that and find out what is in our mind, solitude will always be terribly important. Self-examination and confession. So those kinds of practices, I cannot imagine anybody seriously trying to pursue spiritual growth without engaging in them, always with discernment.
Boy, that's so good. That's such a great introduction for anyone who is newer to spiritual practices. And the solitude in particular, it's funny, I still, and just actually recommended Ruth Barton's book, Invitation to Solitude and Silence, or Silence and Solitude, not long ago. But it almost feels like solitude is subversive these days because of the level of connectivity. And so really great introduction there to just some core disciplines. Now, you're leading a new ministry, I think it launched in 2020, if I recall, called Become New. It's really, really fun to see what you're doing now. And I would love to introduce as many people as I can to Become New. So tell us about what Become New is all about.
Oh, thank you. It really is something that emerged accidentally or providentially. I had left the church where I was serving and was just going through a season of difficulty and pain that involved deep stuff, family stuff, ministry stuff. And almost a year into all that, a friend of mine said, John, you need to not neglect your craft or your calling, that trying to learn and trying to communicate is a part of what God will expect you to steward. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, I have this little thing right here, and I could talk into that and do that like 10 minutes a day and send it out to a few folks. And so I thought, I will do that. So I started, and I would read and study and reflect for several hours a day, kind of load up, and then just record a video. And I had no idea how to send it to anybody. So I sent it to Tim, and I said, you know, if I do this video thing, could you help me figure out how to send it? And we get a list of like 20 people and see if they wanted to get it. And he said, yes. And then it just kind of grew and developed from there. And I think because of the difficulty that I'd been going through, even though the content wasn't focused particularly on difficulty or pain, lots of folks who might have been finding God in hard times in their life resonated with it. Uh-huh. And so there's a story in the New Testament where Jesus goes into the synagogue and there's a man with a withered hand. And, you know, obviously he would want to hide that, especially in a synagogue. And Jesus actually calls him out and says, stand up. And the guy does. So he's very exposed. And then Jesus says, stretch out your hand. The one thing that the man cannot do, doesn't want to do, mm-hmm. is what Jesus asks him to do. And that becomes the moment and the vehicle through which great power flows. And many years ago, when Christianity was underground in Ethiopia, I was with a small gathering of pastors of underground churches, and another pastor who was there with me told that story and just kept talking about how Jesus calls us to do the one thing that we cannot do. And in our inadequacy and shame and failure, God is present with strength. And amazingly, people in that room just started to stand up and confess and weep and cry out to God. And so that story has always been with me, and I ended up, you know, experiencing that much deeper many years later. So on Become New, we will sometimes refer to ourselves as the Fellowship of the Withered Hand.
Oh, I love that. It's such a great introduction to so much of what you've taught and shared and how you've led. And I think it's just, boy, I really encourage all those who are listening to check out Become New. And I've seen it on, seen what you put out on YouTube, but then also I think it's all the same content that's on the streaming or like the podcasting platforms as well, correct?
Yep. Yeah. The idea is, and again, it really grew out of just my own hurt, searching, pain, advice from a friend, and the need to do something daily.
Yeah.
So it's to try to help people grow spiritually one day at a time.
Yeah.
Usually Monday through Friday. It's usually like 10 to 12 minutes long. But again, it wasn't by design. It just turns out, I think, for a lot of us, there's something about 10 or 12 minutes of focusing on God and learning where it's a little longer than just thought for today, but, you know, way shorter than a sermon.
Right.
It's about, yep, I can kind of absorb that and take that into my day. So it's ended up just being a very meaningful journey. Yeah.
I think it's a great format. I would love to think that everybody who's listening right now just cannot wait to get to my next 45-minute sermon upload. But I suspect that a few folks would benefit from something a little bit more accessible from a link standpoint. You have a book coming out, John. It's called Steps. It's coming out in February. I cannot wait to be able to read it. But it's interesting because, not to circle back to John Mark again, but I read online the foreword that he wrote for your new book, Steps. And the quote was, one of the best books he's ever read in his life. So I don't know if what you'd call that a ringing endorsement. To me, I would. I mean, it feels like a pretty kind word about the book, which was good of him to write. But I would just, I know a little bit of the big idea of the book, but having not, it's not on the market yet, obviously. Tell us about what this book really centers around.
Yeah. So this book is making the 12 steps from AA available to everybody as a framework for spiritual growth, whether you have an identified addiction or not.
Okay.
And in a nutshell, the idea is this, that the 12 steps themselves actually grew out of what was called the Oxford Group, which was an attempt in the early 20th century to recapture discipleship. So it was a Lutheran pastor, Frank Buchman, gathered people together. They would practice self-examination and confession to one another in a really open way, service to other people, gathering together on a regular basis, making amends when they had done something wrong, working on conscious contact with God. And what happened was this guy, Bill W., ended up having a vital religious experience and then being connected with one of these Oxford groups. And he found as he engaged in these practices, it enabled him against the powers of hell that he felt like were just going to destroy him to have the power of sobriety one day at a time. And then he met a guy named Dr. Bob, and Dr. Bob ended up getting into an Oxford group and began practicing these same steps. For the next 3 or 4 years, there was no AA, no AA groups, no big, it was just recapturing Christian discipleship in this way. And eventually those practices got kind of codified and semi-secularized to make them available for anybody. But the idea in a nutshell is AA got the 12 steps from the church, and now the church needs them back.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, because one of my questions is going to be, and I think I'm sure, you know, from what I can see about how the book is being communicated and marketed, you can figure out what it's about, but it's not like, hey, 12 steps, you know, for Christians, right in the cover is steps. It's a little bit more subtle than that, because I think some people will read it and think, I'm not an addict. I've heard of the 12 steps. I don't need those. But I think you already answered my question here, which is for the person who's not an addict. You're saying, listen, this didn't start out being for addicts in the first place. This started out just to help Christians step into transformation. And then it actually morphed into what we know it is today. And so it's reclaiming it from the heritage it came from in the first place. It's amazing. What do you think about it is, John, about the 12 steps? They have been so powerful for so many. Yep. What is it about the 12 steps that has led to such transformation?
Yeah. You know, I think it is a classic expression of that very vital dynamic truth that's talked about in Scripture. My strength, God says, is made perfect in weakness. Comes back to the wind of the Spirit blowing through that little boat. So, you know, over the years, what followers of Jesus have always needed is we need a way of life. In the big book of AA, they say everybody needs a program. That's the 12 steps. That's a way of life, practices and rhythms and so. And everybody needs a fellowship. We need to be part of a church. We need to be part of a group, part of have relationships. So in Jesus' day, the way, the program was you just follow Jesus around. Just watch him and do what he does and listen to what he says. And then he's crucified and ascends into heaven. And then you have the Acts 2 church. And they have a way of life they devoted themselves to. Mm. But then Christianity spreads. Pretty soon, the majority of people in the Roman Empire are Christian. And so they believe the right stuff, but there's not a real distinct way of life anymore. So folks start going off in the desert because they say there's got to be a way that's got more power attached to it. And then you have what's called a rule of life sometimes, of Benedict or of Augustine, where people are arranging their lives to receive power. And so periodically you just get that, these little outbursts of here's a pocket where people are practicing a way with great intensity and experiencing great change, and then it gets diluted. And what happens in the 20th century is, again, there's a recapturing of a way. And because of the nature of addiction, people who are addicted know, if I don't get help from God, I'm going to die. And they're just facing hell. And so they have this desperate quality that says, I got to have this. I will try it with all my might. And so it's the very pain, weakness, challenge of addiction that creates desperation. Mm-hmm. Desperation is a wonderful gift. And then it makes them say, I'm willing to surrender. I'm willing to do a fearless and searching moral inventory. I'm willing to admit the exact nature of my wrongs to God, myself, and to one other person. I'm willing to go make amends. So it really is, I think, the pain and power of weakness, addiction, that created a kind of forcing function and provided literal empirical verification. Mm-hmm. For the 12 steps, they are just a way of life. They don't involve medication. They are just spiritual practices. But you think in most of our churches, if somebody came into our church and we said, do church the way that we do it. And oh, by the way, if you're an addict, you will get sobriety thrown in as a byproduct. It usually doesn't happen, but that's what happened in AA.
Mm-hmm.
So I had one friend that's been in AA for many, many years who said to me when I first started to study this real deeply, he said, I think before you get too far into this, you will feel jealous that you're not an alcoholic.
Hmm.
And I came to understand what he meant. And often for people who experience that, when they go through it, they end up saying, thank God that I was an addict, because it's the only way that it's put me into a way of life, a program, and a fellowship that, quite apart from my addiction issues, have put me in touch with God and spiritual reality and a life-changing way of life that I would never have known otherwise.
I think that's such a beautiful and powerful statement. Here is the thing from a pastoral perspective that strikes me as a real challenge. What you're saying, and I totally agree, and it happens not just with addiction, but oftentimes in suffering, is we are broken down to a point where we say, I cannot do this.
Yeah.
How do we, and then that propels us to say, I'm willing to engage in, let's say in the case of 12-step groups or AA, I'm willing to engage in this community that's going to be this earnest about pursuing this way of life together. How do we get there without that desperation? I don't think we can, probably. How do we help people take steps towards that desperation apart from, you know, obviously we're not going to say, hey, if you could get addicted first, that can help me later.
Right. Well,
I mean, it strikes me as
addiction cultivation, and then everybody will be there.
Yeah. It strikes me at some level, you know, in the modern church, I don't think people always love talking about sin, but at some level, that is part of the gateway to experiencing and understanding our brokenness. I'm curious, though, how would you say we help cultivate as pastors and leaders that sense of desperation that would lead us to engage in a way of life that will ultimately lead to greater flourishing?
Yeah. You know, Brian, very often those of us who preach or people who write will raise that question, talk about that. Why can't church be more like an AA meeting? Because in AA, as my friend Mike says, the worse your story, the warmer your welcome.
Mm.
And whatever anybody has been through, they know when they walk into an AA meeting and just make that initial confession, my name is John, I'm an alcoholic, whatever it is, welcome, John, you know, that they will be embraced. And there's just this gut-wrenching level of honesty. You go to meetings, and I will often go to them and find them quite helpful. And, you know, people talk about losing jobs, losing marriages, car accidents, I mean, just absolute train wrecks in their lives. I can't believe how open and honest people are. How come church can't be more that way? And there's one whole book that's just called Why Can't Church Be More Like an AA Meeting?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the answer to that question is it can, as long as church attenders are willing to be more like alcoholics. And that's the difficulty. We're not quite sure that we want to do that. So really, that comes down, I think, Brian, to what Dallas Willard would have talked about as a vision issue. You know, when you think about vision, really the first two steps of the 12 steps are about vision. Dallas would often talk about change involves a little acronym VIM, vision, intention, and method.
Mm.
And so those first two steps are a vision. An effective vision always is marked by unforced desire.
Mm.
It's a man that finds a treasure buried in a field, finds a pearl of great price. I got to have that. I can't miss that. So the first step, I'm powerless over something. My life is not manageable. Might be death, might be my spouse, might be my marriage, might be this habit. I gotta have help. And in AA, after they've been going for a while, they talked about how you gotta hit bottom, but maybe they gotta raise the bottom. Like instead of waiting around until you're just about to die from alcohol, if you reflect on, oh, this is what my life will be like if I keep drinking. Here's my life without God. Here's my life with God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our problem is we just tolerate mediocrity. We all do. So recognizing and experiencing the pain of the gap of sin.
Yeah.
That's the negative side. And then the second step is the hope side. First step is just hopeless. I can't. And it's a real good thing for people to actually feel the sting of hopelessness. Mm-hmm. Our culture tries to tell us you can. Nope, that's the gospel. I can't. All we like sheep. And then the second step is the step of hope. Came to believe that there is one who is greater than me and he can restore. So that's the positive side. And sometimes with Jesus, it was the positive side, the pearl of great price, the beauty of having a life of meaning. Follow me and I will make you fishers of men. Fisher, I can't miss that. I got to have that. So I think starting with the vision and helping us experience the pain. You know, one of the problems is you go to an AA meeting when somebody says, my name is John, I'm an alcoholic. They have been through hell to be able to say that sentence. They have avoided saying it. They have denied it. They have been confronted. They have lost money, jobs, marriage. When they say that, everybody knows they have been through fire to get to that point. Problem is we go to church and say, I'm a sinner, but we haven't been through the same process.
Mm-hmm.
But there have been times in the history of the church when people have. You know, in the Acts 2 church, people weren't there casually. If they were there, it was like they desperately wanted and needed to be there. So helping people to gain that vision, feel that gap,
yeah,
pain,
that's good,
or beauty, and then calling people to the decision, turn my life and will over to the care of God. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the steps are really about method, fearless and searching, moral inventory, and confessing. And again, none of that stuff is rocket science. All those are steps that anybody who's been around church for a while will recognize.
Yeah.
They're just being done in a coherent, kind of logical way. And also, you're never done with them. One of the difficulties in churches is people will think of discipleship as a program that I can get through. Did that curriculum. The steps are very actionable. They're very concrete. They're not mechanical. They're not legalistic. But they give me enough to work on between now until the day I die.
That's so good. And I think that one thing that I'm actually speaking about this Sunday a little bit, I think one thing that makes it hard for people sometimes to fully own and look at their own brokenness and need is if we're not rooted in our own belovedness first, if we are not secure in our identity in Christ and his great affection for us, it is really, really hard to be candid about the broken places. It's security in his love for me that really gives me the confidence to look at the ugly parts of me that need to be transformed. And I guess just adding that into the mix, I really think that this book is going to be so powerful. And I know many are already looking forward to it with great expectation, in part because so many have said, wouldn't it be great if the church could be more like an AA meeting? So it's going to be really exciting to see how the Spirit of God uses this work to reclaim some of that for the church. And we can say, hey, this isn't just an AA meeting. This is our community. This is our fabric of faith. If folks are looking to find you, John, what's the best place? We mentioned Becoming New. Any other places that you would like to share as far as them following your work?
I think at Become New, becomenew.com, if somebody's interested and they log on there, you know, the online teaching stuff that I'm doing is there, and you know, whatever writing, I think there's a spot there where if I'm speaking someplace, that will show up there as well. So that will probably give you more than you would want to know.
Well, again, thanks for coming on today, John. And I just am so very excited that you're writing and will be first in line when Steps comes out. And appreciate your ministry on a daily basis now with the video work. And I'm excited for what is to come for you. And as far as looking forward to the future, man, just keep up the good work. I know God's got it. I don't know what it will behold, but you've got a new season of ministry in front of you with what you're doing online and your writing. And I just I'm really, really excited to see what this next phase will take. So thank you so much for coming on today, and look forward to hopefully talking someday in the future.
Well, I will look forward to that, Brian. Hope it happens soon, and just God pour out great blessings, as many as you can absorb, on Amen. You and your family and life and ministry. And thanks for the chance to talk.
Thanks. Well, hey, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with John Ortberg. I know it was an utter privilege for me to interview somebody who's been a ministry hero and a great influence on my life. And listen, if you're new to this whole conversation about spiritual disciplines or spiritual practices, don't let those words intimidate you. All of these things are is helping train you for the full life God made you for. And so I would really encourage you to check out some of John's works. We mentioned them today during the conversation. And that will help you take you further into exploring these topics further. And I hope implementing them in your life. Again, it's about securing and experiencing the abundant life Jesus came to bring. So if you've enjoyed this conversation, please do rate and review the podcast. As I've said many times, that helps us get the word out about Made to Advance. This has been a production of Engedi Church, and we've got more incredible conversations on the way. And so until next time, just know God made you to advance.